Workers' feet tramped down the well-worn path toward the village, cresting the last rise as the walled enclosure spread out below them to the south. The sun, blessedly, had set behind the hills to the west, but the ground was still baked hot underneath their feet, like touching the outside of an oven that was still in use. The omnipresent dust stained their loincloths and kilts a dull gray, almost indistinguishable from their dust-stained skin, which was broken only by the darker trails left by the rivulets of sweat that had poured out of them on their long hike. But now they were almost home. The week was over at last, after 8 days of continuous labor and 2 short nights spent in the tiny 1- and 2-room huts on the edge of the sharp-edged valley where they worked. Set Maat, the place of truth, their village, lay just a few steps away. The workers could smell home, baking bread in the ovens, roasting fish, stews cooking over the hearth. Their mouths watered after days of stale rations. They could see their wives, children, elderly parents, and relatives waiting for them. Smiles and waves and shouts of greeting filled the depression in which the village was situated. A little girl ran to hug her father, a stonemason. A carpenter handed his son a tiny wooden boat that he'd spent his long nights carving. The scribe saw his old father, who had been the scribe in this village before him, and asked whether his infected eyes had improved thanks to the doctor's treatment. They had, and the elderly man felt much better. One strong-featured woman of middling years spat at the sight of her husband, who had recently gotten drunk and beaten her. He didn't know yet that she was preparing to go to the village law court about the matter. A recently married quarry worker caught sight of his wife and grinned. They were expecting a child soon, their first. For 2 days, the workers' time would be their own. Some would drink too much beer and sleep away half the day. Others would leave Set Maat and walk down to the river to trade. Others would tramp over to the cemeteries on either side of the village to work on the tombs in which they would eventually be buried, a lifelong activity. The quality of their work, naturally, was exceptional. After all, these were the workers who built the pharaoh's own tomb. The care was their responsibility. From the moment the king took his throne to the moment he was interred in the Valley of the Kings. They were proud of their occupations, proud of this village, where most of them had roots going back decades and even centuries. The people of this village in Egypt's new kingdom, a place we call Deir el-Medina, were common folk, not nobles or high priests or royalty. But it's thanks to them, thanks to their labor and their skill and their ingenuity, that we have the great monuments of ancient Egypt at all. Common people were the backbone of even the most famous civilizations. Without them, kings and the powerful were nothing. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. The vast majority of our collective understanding of ancient Egypt revolves around the highest portion of its elite, the pharaohs. Mummies, their mortal remains, the items they took to the afterlife, the tombs they built to house those remains and the items that went with them, the battles they won or claimed to have won, the temples they constructed to celebrate their accomplishments, the statues and art that depicted them. But pharaohs and their families, and even the functionaries, administrators, and priests who made up the top tier of ancient Egyptian society, represented only the tiniest portion of the whole population. It was Egypt's common folk who built the pyramids and the stunning tombs in the Valley of the Kings, who fought in the pharaoh's armies to win those battles, who grew the crops and tended the livestock and baked the bread that sustained Egypt and its people. In practically every way, they inhabited a dramatically different world than that of the pharaohs. Today's episode is all about those regular people, and it's focused around one single question. What were their lives like? There are many different ways of answering that question, but there are also more than a few problems and caveats. First and foremost among them is the fact that the vast majority of the surviving evidence from ancient Egypt does not pertain to the non-elite. It's one of the great ironies of Egypt's history, and history more generally, that the monuments these people constructed with their sweat and blood to honor and celebrate the gods and their kings have a much greater probability of remaining than any fragment of their own lives. It's a lot more likely that a temple built from stone will survive for a few thousand years than a village of mud brick houses near the Nile. A painstakingly prepared royal mummy placed in a magnificent individual tomb built by those workers at Deir el-Medina has a better chance of lasting through the millennia than the bones of a fisherman dropped into a lonely pit in the Nile Delta. On top of problems of survival, there's a problem of emphasis and choice. Egyptology has been around for a couple of centuries now, and for much of the field's existence, its practitioners have been more inclined to excavate royal tombs and palaces and temples than the cemeteries and homes of the people who built them. On the one hand, that was because of these monuments' prominence in the landscape. On the other, it was a product of the fact that it was self-evident to a great many of these scholars that the elite simply mattered more than everybody else, and that they deserved the lion's share of the attention. Now, Egyptology is far from unique in that regard. This has changed dramatically in the last half century or more, and there have been a ton of wonderful excavations of non-elite cemeteries, villages, and workplaces. Studies of ancient Egypt's common folk have exploded in number and quality. There's more than enough material with which to make today's episode and still have a ton left over. But there are enormous gaps in our knowledge. We know a great deal more about the lives of common people during the New Kingdom from around 1500 BC to 1100 BC than about common people even in the Middle Kingdom a few centuries before. We know a lot more about the workforce at the village of Deir al-Medina, the place we met at the beginning, these people who built the tombs in the Valley of the Kings near Thebes, than about, say, cattle herders living around the first cataract of the Nile near Elephantine. Because of the ubiquity of cemeteries and the importance of burials, we usually know a lot more about death than about life. We know a lot more about how kings wanted common people to see them than about how common people saw their kings. I emphasize this because it's important to understand the limits of what we know. There are places and times in ancient Egypt where we have incredible insight into the lives of non-elites, really granular details about their work and their health and their beliefs about how the world worked. Perhaps the things we learn from those times and places reflect broader sets of experiences among the common people of ancient Egypt at that time, and maybe for centuries before and after too. But maybe they don't. Either because things were different in different places, or because things changed over time. We've talked in previous episodes about the tendency to see Egypt as eternal and unchanging. We know that's not the case. There were continuities in ancient Egypt, but there was also a great deal of change. Sometimes change even masqueraded as continuity, or vice versa. For all those reasons, it's essential to be precise about the nature of the evidence at our disposal and its context. That's why today's episode will focus on the New Kingdom. It's the period that provides most of our evidence for the lives of everyday folk, and we can remain agnostic on the issue of its applicability to earlier or later times. Now, it's worth stopping for a moment to try to understand what we mean when we talk about elites and non-elites. By the most generous estimate, only about 3 to 5% of the population of ancient Egypt would have been what we consider to be elite, the people to whom the vast majority of the attention in both modern and ancient times has been directed. That leaves at least 95% in that other category. Ancient Egyptians had a distinction between haves and have-nots, for which they had opposing terms, something like pit and hrit, that appears consistently through much of Egypt's history. There are texts that suggest they drew a hard line between professions that didn't require manual labor, like, say, being a scribe, which was a pretty high-status job, and those that did require manual labor, like being a barber, a potter, coppersmith, or a common laborer. The Egyptologist Delphine Driot argues that elite Egyptians maintained strong social stigmas against non-elites. For example, they depicted them as being physically different. Hairy, hunched over, pot-bellied in images, and smaller than their social betters in tomb art. This physical difference matches a vocabulary for the poor that refers to them as destitute, weaklings, wretched, and above all, impoverished. Now, it's less certain how this dichotomy between rich and poor, haves and have-nots, actually mapped onto Egyptian society in the New Kingdom. It seems clear that 95% of the population wasn't destitute. Skilled artisans, like those who worked on the tombs of the pharaohs in the Valley of the Kings, again, those people we met at the very beginning, were much better off than vagrants who begged for a living. They were what one text refers to with a term translated as, quote-unquote, bad poor. There's no doubt that the New Kingdom had a strong social hierarchy, that there was a distinction between rich slash powerful and poor, and that there was a stigma associated with that distinction. What's less clear is to precisely which segments of that 95% of common, working people our evidence pertains. Almost certainly not the bad poor, definitely to at least some of the better-off artisans like sculptors, tomb painters, draftsmen. But we have a lot less of an idea about the farmers, fisherfolk, potters, and laborers in between those at the very bottom and those up further the social scale. So with that said, let's go over the evidence that we have. From what sources can we learn about the lives of common people in the New Kingdom? Where does it come from? For the New Kingdom, we're lucky to have multiple strong lines of evidence that we can combine to tell not one, but a whole series of stories about non-elites. There are abundant textual records in the form of papyri, which preserve really well in the arid environment of Egypt, and what are called ostraca. These are fragments of pottery or limestone with writing on them. The singular is ostracon. The ancient Egyptians had a particular form of writing. It was much different than the hieroglyphics used from monumental inscriptions in tombs and temples that was really well suited to these media. It was called hieratic script, and it was a cursive that was really well suited to being written with a reed pen and ink. Reed pen, if you've never tried one, is actually quite easy and pleasant to write with. The tip absorbs the ink, and it's a lot like writing with a small Sharpie marker. The upshot is that we have a pretty considerable quantity of texts, ranging from records of legal disputes between neighbors to lists of people who were absent for a day of work in the Valley of the Kings to poetry and love songs and everything in between. A number of non-elite settlements have been excavated over the past century as well, giving us insight into houses and domestic life, everything from where people ate and slept to where they baked their bread. We also have some excavations of work sites, like quarries and workshops. But, as we've discussed many times over the course of our episodes on Egypt, death was a big deal. Cemeteries were core features in the landscape, some of which were used and reused for centuries. They could contain thousands upon thousands of burials. Most of the attention, of course, goes to royal burials, and to a lesser extent, those of the broader elite beyond them. Now, some Egyptologists have argued that the bodies of poor and common people were either discarded or thrown in the Nile for disposal, but more recent interpretations firmly contradict this. Common people were buried in cemeteries, their burials were important to them, and they have survived in quite significant numbers. They may not survive as often as elite tombs, but that has more to do with the sites of the cemeteries and the consistent practice of reuse of burial spaces than a lack of importance or emphasis from the people themselves. As with elites, less exalted Egyptians were also quite often buried in coffins and provided with grave goods, like amulets, jewelry, pottery vessels, and at the very least, some reed mats or blankets. Beyond the grave goods and the burial context, we also have the human remains themselves, and they have their own story to tell. Bones can be sampled for ancient DNA to tell us about ancestry, stable isotopes to provide data on diet and mobility. But even more than that, injuries, patterns of activity, disease, nutrition, and general health are all things that we can discern from remains. Now, that tells us a great deal about an individual. And when we do it at scale, we can put together a surprisingly detailed portrait of whole populations' working lives and health. So we have a bunch of different sources of evidence about common folk in the New Kingdom. But they don't provide uniform coverage of every place and time within that period. There are some spots about which we know a great deal more than others. First and foremost among these is the village of Deir el-Medina, which I've mentioned a couple of times now, and we met at the beginning. It was located near the key city of Thebes. Deir el-Medina was where the workers who built and decorated the royal tombs in the Valley of the Kings lived, and was within easy walking distance of their workplace. This village was inhabited for almost four centuries, and it is the richest site anywhere in the ancient world when it comes to the combination of domestic buildings, burials and human remains, and above all, texts relating to the lives of ordinary people. We'll talk a lot more about Deir el-Medina in today's episode, but it's essential to note the scale of the debt that we owe to this one particular site for telling us about the conditions under which working folk lived. On the one hand, this is a tremendous blessing. We have access to things like love charms, prescriptions for cures for eye ailments, and descriptions of domestic violence and adultery. On the other hand, however, the inhabitants of Deir el-Medina cannot stand in for all of ancient Egypt's working people. They were state employees, their work was specialized, and many were quite highly skilled, like draftsmen, so they're more likely to be what we might think of as middle or even upper middle class than members of the very lowest strata of society. But rather than despair about what we don't and can't know, I'd like to use Deir el-Medina as our touchstone throughout the rest of this episode. It's a place we know was inhabited by members of the non-elite, even if they weren't necessarily typical of the rest of society. It's a truly wonderful spot against which to compare what we see elsewhere. So, let's get to know Deir el-Medina.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
It's only a bit of an exaggeration to say that a history of common working people in the New Kingdom is really a story about the people of Deir al-Medina. The chances are good that if you pick up a book on daily life in ancient Egypt, what it was like to live in a village full of people who weren't the pharaoh, it's going to be based to a shocking degree on evidence from this one site. The sheer quantity and quality of evidence that comes from this lonely village tucked into a desert valley, away from the destructive effects of the Nile's water table and subsequent millennia of habitation, dwarfs what we have from elsewhere. We have thousands and thousands of texts of all kinds, written on both papyrus and shards of pottery or pieces of the fine local limestone. The village itself, not just the residences, but also the granaries, temples, and other buildings, survives in a wonderful state of preservation. So too do the tombs of Deir al-Medina's inhabitants, built with the same exceptional care and skill that went into their work for the pharaohs in the Valley of the Kings. The contents of those tombs, ranging from amulets and coffins to the remains of the people themselves, round out our available evidence for this unique site. When we put it all together, we gain unparalleled insight into the lives of non-elites over centuries during the New Kingdom. Deir al-Medina was purpose-built for the people who lived there, a quote-unquote company town, in the words of the Egyptologist A.G. McDowell, constructed for a group of specialized workers with an essential job, designing, building, and decorating the tombs of the New Kingdom's pharaohs. The village was a little bit out of the way, located just beyond the fringes of the capital city of Thebes on the opposite side of the river, situated in a dusty and rather inhospitable little cleft in the hills surrounding the Valley of the Kings. Truth be told, it wasn't a great place to put a village. The nearest source of water was a half mile and 20-minute slog away, there were no trees at all, and the dry hillsides managed to reflect sunlight down onto Deir al-Medina while effectively blocking the pleasant breezes that swept through neighboring valleys. Today, the summer temperatures there rise as high as 130 degrees Fahrenheit, around 55 degrees Celsius. You'd hardly know that the green, welcoming Nile Valley was just a few miles away. Deir al-Medina's great advantage, the entire reason the site was occupied for almost four centuries, was its proximity to the Valley of the Kings. Less than 2 kilometers, about 1.2 miles, separate Deir al-Medina from the valley, though it would have been a fairly taxing climb through the hills to reach the work sites. Despite its closeness to Thebes, Deir al-Medina could be seen as an out-of-the-way place. The workers were almost but not quite sequestered, probably to preserve the secrecy of their work on royal tombs. Tomb robbery was a common phenomenon in Egypt. After all, who could resist a store of riches buried just beneath the surface? Even kings weren't immune. Far from it. In times of instability and disorder, a freshly deceased king might be separated from his immortal possessions within years or even months of his burial. The pyramid of one of the last rulers of the Old Kingdom, Pepi II, was probably plundered by the very same workers who had built it, judging by the ease with which they got around its extensive safeguards. Practically all of the tombs in the Valley of the Kings were eventually robbed. The only reason we have so many royal mummies from the New Kingdom is because they were eventually collected from their plundered tombs and placed together in a cache in Deir el-Bari, between Deir el-Medina and the Valley of the Kings. Pharaohs and their administrators were well aware of this, so keeping the workforce under surveillance and away from the general populace was a pretty good step toward preventing this kind of burglary. Building a king's tomb was a big job. It began at the start of a pharaoh's reign, and it lasted for years or even decades. Deir el-Medina was built for this purpose near the beginning of the New Kingdom, and it was occupied for the entirety of that period and beyond. The walls surrounding the earliest part of the village contained bricks bearing the name of Thutmose I, who ruled around 1500 BC, so must have been occupied no later than his reign, and probably earlier. Now, the early tombs of the New Kingdom weren't especially complex constructions in comparison to what came later, with decorations only in the burial chamber, antechamber, and burial shaft rather than the whole expanse. That partially explains the fact that the vast majority of our written evidence from the site dates to no later than the end of the 18th dynasty, after the religious turmoil of Akhenaten's reign and the death of Tutankhamun. Not as many people probably lived at Deir el-Medina, because not as many people were necessary to build and decorate the royal tombs, and only a few of those people needed to be literate. That changed around 1300 BC, as royal tombs became much grander constructions. For the next 150 or so years, the village was a thriving little spot in those dry hills west of Thebes. During the reign of Ramesses the Great, it reached its greatest extent, with at least 68 workers' houses and probably more contained within the walls of Deir el-Medina. At its peak, then, several hundred people would have called the village home. For them, it was Set Maat, the place of truth. Building and decorating royal tombs was a generational occupation. It was the workers' job for their entire working life. Sons followed fathers into the workforce, they learned as apprentices on the job, and the inhabitants of Deir el-Medina often married one another. One census document, for example, lists a Thutmose, son of Khemeje, who lived two doors down from his sister Tenetpaip. People were born in Deir el-Medina, they worked there and in the surrounding valleys, and they were buried in tombs cut into the soft limestone of the surrounding hills. This obviously isn't to say that people never left, that newcomers never arrived, or that the village was cut off from the outside world. None of that's the case. The workers were sometimes loaned out to work on other royal projects, and they did work for the elite of nearby Thebes, which was a pretty cosmopolitan place. Some of them even did work on the temples at Karnak and Luxor, according to inscriptions on their tombs. Tomb paintings and written texts tell us that the people of the village went down to the river to trade for fish and other food, drinks, cloth, and whatever else wasn't immediately available. But Deir el-Medina was still a self-contained community with its own history, its traditions, and generations of family life contained within its workers' huts and public buildings. The deities were local. The snake goddess Meretseger was the most prominent at Deir el-Medina, but there were a whole bunch of others. These folks knew and lived in the landscape. It was dotted with well-used little shrines and cemeteries. It meant something to them. Even after the village was eventually abandoned due to raids from marauding desert people, we know that descendants of its residents, people who still worked on the royal tombs being built nearby, came there occasionally to visit the homes of their ancestors. To me, this is one of the great insights that Deir el-Medina offers us in thinking about common people in ancient Egypt more broadly. Their lives were primarily local. The primary units through which they experienced the world were their households, kin groups, their occupations, and the village, all of which overlapped with one another. At most, their feelings were regional. People at Deir el-Medina felt particularly close to Thebes, for example. Any sense of themselves as Egyptians was dramatically less important than these localized ties to their immediate neighbors, relatives, and communities. No matter how greatly the workers of Deir el-Medina differed from their counterparts in the thousands of farming villages, wandering herders' encampments, and urban neighborhoods scattered throughout Egypt, this would have been the case. The relationships that defined who they were, their identities, were all around them every day, created in the conversations between workers on the long hike to the Valley of the Kings, the gossip passing between families living in neighboring houses, and the notes hastily scribbled on a limestone ostracon. When the people of Deir el-Medina wanted to renovate their homes, something they did regularly, they employed the services of their neighbor the draftsman. As much as we might talk about high politics and wars in distant lands and what have you, the lives of common people took place on a much humbler scale. Even for the villagers of Deir el-Medina, who worked directly for the king and were much more closely tied to the state than the vast majority of ancient Egyptians probably were, all that seems to be pretty distant in the records of their lives. They were building the king's tomb. They were doing other work for high officials and queens. They were surrounded by monuments to dead kings, which were a continuous presence in the landscape. But as long as their wages, paid in the form of food, firewood, pottery, and even servants' labor, were provided as promised, and the work was planned and executed, they got on with things regardless of who was in charge. Deir el-Medina was full of people of varying occupations. After all, a tomb had to be designed, cut into the stone, and then decorated with plaster, paint, art, writing, and the like. Normally, the written sources tell us, the workforce was between 50 and 60 men, with a couple of administrators, foremen, basically, to organize all the work. One or more scribes also resided in the village. On top of that, the village itself had to be provided with basic services: wood cutting, water carrying, washing, flour grinding, and the like. The people who did these more menial tasks as their primary occupation don't seem to have lived in Deir el-Medina itself, but in other communities nearby. No doubt they were part of that broader community web as well, with people moving between these villages at various points in their lives. Even though fathers tried to pass down their occupations to their sons and residents married within the village, there was never enough work to keep everybody at home permanently. Young people would have to leave, and that created connections to other villages and places. The sons of the foreman Neferhotep did particularly well. One became a scribe in the army, and the other had a variety of jobs, including doorman in the massive nearby temple and administrative complex of Ramesses the Great. It's a nice step up. As I mentioned, the workers at Deir el-Medina were paid directly by the state in the form of the necessities of life: grain, fish, wood, water, pottery, and labor. In this, they were unlike the vast majority of Egyptians, who were sowing, reaping, grinding, caring for livestock, and the like in the lands ruled by the pharaoh. By the later part of the New Kingdom, there may have been 4 or 5 million people living in Egypt, 2.1 million of them in the Nile Valley alone, according to one estimate. This was one of the most densely populated areas of the ancient world, near or at its peak. Such was the fertility of Egypt that a single farmer was thought to be able to work 20 arura of land every year. That was the unit they used, which would have been enough to provide food for between 10 and 20 people. Agricultural productivity and labor was what made all that other stuff, temple building, tomb construction, army campaigns, possible. But even at Deir el-Medina, agricultural life was never far away, either figuratively or literally. Some of the workers maintained huts, quote, down by the river, as they put it, closer to fertile land, the bounty of the river, and Thebes. The village's residents owned farming equipment, draft animals, storage facilities, and land. In one case, a certain Wen Nefer is listed as owning 17 arura of farmland. The village workers used their donkeys for their work, of course, but they might also rent them out to others for use for cultivation. One text explicitly states that an ox was loaned out for plowing. So even though Deir el-Medina seems at first glance to have been kind of an out-of-the-way artisan's village, it was in fact closely tied to the mainstream of Egyptian life.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
So now we have a sense for what Deir el-Medina was and how it fit into New Kingdom Egypt more broadly. It wasn't exactly a typical place because of its residents' specialized jobs, their direct ties to the state, and the village's out-of-the-way location, but it also wasn't completely unlike the rest of Egypt. The villagers were in regular contact with the outside world, especially the major nearby city of Thebes. They had easy access to farmland and the omnipresent Nile. But what were their lives like? What did they do with their time? Where did they spend their time? What did they see around them? How did they feel about it? There are a number of different ways to answer those questions, and we'll begin with work. I mentioned earlier that the tomb builders who resided in Deir el-Medina had a variety of specializations, that there was a hierarchy within both the work gangs and the village more broadly. At the top were the two foremen, one for each of the two work gangs, left and right, one for each side of the tomb, into which the workers were divided. The foremen were appointed directly by the vizier of the king, the most important official in all of Egypt, because the king's tomb was one of the most important projects in the country, and it therefore fell under his direct purview. The foremen acted as liaisons between the state and the workers. They oversaw the whole plan of construction and decoration, and they played an important role in regulating village life as well. At least one scribe also resided in the village, and like the foreman, he was employed directly by the state. He probably had even more contact with state administrators than the foreman did, because he was constantly submitting written reports and requests and receiving instructions in return. Here's an excerpt from one report written by the scribe Neferhotep to the vizier. Quote, "I am working in the tombs of the royal children, which my lord ordered to be constructed. I am working very well and very efficiently, with good work and with efficient work. May my lord not be concerned about it." He then goes on to complain about late deliveries of wages and materials, which were also his purview. "A load of 10 unit stone is not light," he complains, referring to the hauling of stone to and from the worksite. "May my lord act to make for us a means of sustenance." But despite their direct ties to the state, the foremen and scribes weren't necessarily outsiders. The foreman Kahi was the son of a chief carpenter. Paneb, who started as a stonemason, was the son of a common workman. Unk, a scribe, was the son of a sculptor in the village. Another was the son of a workman. So even the highest status positions in the village could be and often were filled by people who had been born and raised in Deir al-Medina. Below this top rung of appointed positions were the skilled workers, draftsmen, painters, sculptors, plasterers, and carpenters. At the bottom of the village's hierarchy, at least among the men, were the common laborers, the men who scraped the rough shape of the tomb into the soft limestone of the Valley of the Kings. Now, there don't seem to have been any really poor people in Deir al-Medina in comparison to the enslaved people and agricultural laborers elsewhere in Egypt. But the work could be brutally hard. Imagine boring into a limestone cliff with nothing but hand tools, carrying away baskets full of spoil, hauling timber and mixing plaster, and doing it all under the blazing sun of an Egyptian summer. To even get to the Valley of the Kings, the workers had to hike 2 kilometers, over a mile, through the hills with a significant elevation gain. It's no wonder, then, that during periods of peak activity, the workers seem to have spent much of the work week living in small huts on the last hill before the descent into the valley. These were humble little 1 or 2 room stone shelters, roofed with branches, but the workers spent enough time there to leave graffiti, decorate their door frames, discard pieces of sculpture and bits of limestone with writing on them. Most of their time, however, was spent either on site in the Valley of the Kings or at home in Deir al-Medina. Analysis of textual records suggests that the workers would make the hike from the village to the valley 161 times per year on average. A worker's career might last 25 to 35 years before retirement, often in favor of a son who would take over his father's position in the work gang. The physical toll of this labor and their hike to the valley, despite the relatively elevated status of the workers, must have been high. A 2016 study by the Egyptologist Ann Austin found extremely high rates of osteoarthritis in the lower limbs among men buried in the cemetery at Deir al-Medina. It's precisely what you would expect from people who had to climb hills and haul heavy loads for a living. One text recording absences from work in the Valley of the Kings mentions 2 different workers who were off that day due to leg injuries. The women of Deir al-Medina, by contrast, suffered from lower rates of leg injuries and osteoarthritis, supporting the idea that this was probably work-related. The village's doctor, a member of the work gang who also provided medical care as part of his duties, was kept busy dealing with a wide variety of ailments. We can imagine him setting fractures and sewing up lacerations, dealing with eye ailments that kept workers off the job, and mixing up medicines and suppositories. Medical texts found at Deir al-Medina mention issues ranging from cancerous or gangrenous sores to hemorrhoids to rashes to coughs and heart problems. But it's almost certain that the people of Deir al-Medina were better off than most of Egypt's other common people. Skilled workers could do business for themselves outside of their work for the king with no objection from the authorities. Foremen may even have provided extra days off to facilitate these side jobs. Carpenters in particular, who built the scaffolding for the royal tombs, ran a thriving trade. They built beds, chairs, tables, and coffins for their neighbors, while sculptors might make articles for the temples and nobles of nearby Thebes. Those skilled workers used the extra income for a variety of purposes, including bribing the foremen to accept their sons as members of the work gang, and also to invest in enslaved people, agricultural land, draft animals, and property down by the river. They also used it to buy extra food and necessities, since their wages from the state were often in arrears, sometimes so significantly that the workers at Deir al-Medina went on strike. But no matter how hard life might be at Deir al-Medina, it could definitely be worse elsewhere in Egypt. The laborers and artisans who built the king's tomb weren't what ancient Egyptians called bad poor, the vagrants and unemployed who sat at the very bottom of the social ladder. But the workers buried in the South Tomb Cemetery at the city of Amarna, the short-lived capital of the religious zealot Akhenaten, weren't at the bottom either, and their remains show just how brutally hard their lives could be. So a note here, for this section, I'm drawing mostly on a 2013 article in the journal Antiquity led by Barry Kemp. The South Tomb Cemetery at Amarna contains several thousand graves, a shocking number considering how briefly Amarna was occupied, all of them belonging to the common people who made their way to live and work in the pharaoh Akhenaten's new city. Their remains tell a series of stories about the difficulties of their lives from birth to death. Beginning in early childhood, no later than 7.5 months of age, the people buried in the South Tomb Cemetery suffered from severe nutritional and disease stressors. They didn't have enough to eat, they were afflicted with illnesses, and as they got older, the extreme stress of heavy labor took its toll. They were short. Men averaged 5'4.5" in height, 164 centimeters, while women were just 5'1.5", 154 centimeters. These are some of the shortest people from any period of Egypt's history. The women are the shortest of any sample from any period of Egypt's history. This is important because height is a great indicator of just how stressed a group of people really are. It's so sensitive to environmental, nutritional, and epidemiological inputs during childhood and adolescence. So on top of these general nutritional deficiencies, the people buried at Amarna often lacked iron in their diets. Some show evidence of scurvy, vitamin C deficiency. Almost 80% of the adults in the cemetery showed some kind of degenerative joint disorder, and more than half of those suffered from a severe case. Traumatic injuries were common. Broken arms and legs, cracked ribs, and fractured vertebrae all show up across the sample in large numbers. Even two of the teenagers buried in the cemetery show significant trauma, including a fractured vertebra and broken bones in the foot. More gruesome are healed fractures of the scapula, the shoulder blade, found in 5 adult men. These were almost certainly the result of corporal punishment for some crime, one of what were called the 5 open wounds. They were non-lethal spear thrusts administered along with 100 or 200 blows. So when we put all these pieces together, they tell a story of lives spent in extraordinarily hard labor. The authors of the Antiquity paper point to the work of hauling standardized limestone blocks weighing about 70 kilos, 154 pounds apiece, each of which was supposed to be done by a single person. Do that often enough, over a long enough period of time, and the laborer's body will show precisely the kinds of degenerative conditions and traumatic injuries that we see in the sample of people buried in Amarna. Topped off with a healthy dose of physical punishment, it's hardly a recipe for a life of leisure. But despite the difficulty of their lives, the eternal residents of the South Tomb Cemetery had been better off than many in Egyptian society, at least in the years immediately prior to their deaths. Excavators at Amarna have uncovered an entire workman's village, a totally square, walled space filled with somewhere around 70 identical houses. The people seem to have eaten decently enough. They focused particularly on raising pigs, and they seem to have done some weaving in their homes on the side. In death, they were buried with care. Some had grave goods, including jewelry and amulets, or pottery vessels with burial offerings. A few were buried in coffins. One even had unintelligible hieroglyphs that had been copied by an illiterate worker for an illiterate client. The graves were marked on the surface with a limestone cairn, maybe an engraved stela, and in a few cases, a small limestone pyramid. So as brutal as their working conditions may have been, they probably represented a step up from where these people had begun their lives. As strange as it might seem for a society that appears to be founded on the strictest possible social hierarchy, with the pharaoh at the top, small wealthy elite next, and everybody else below, there was room for some measure of social mobility in ancient Egypt. We've already discussed a couple of examples of it in Deir al-Medina, with the sons of common workmen becoming skilled artisans, foremen, and scribes. At least in that village, education was available. At one point, perhaps as much as 40% of its population was literate. That would have made it unusual or even unique in the Egypt of its time. Now, there's zero sign of literacy in the workmen's village at Amarna, for example. Now, notice I just said sons. Things were very different for women. All of the Diyadan Medina villagers who worked on the royal tombs were men. Work was highly gendered in ancient Egypt as a matter of course, but especially so at Diyadan Medina. Women's labor wasn't solely directed toward their households, though. Women wove cloth, and there is abundant evidence for women as active traders in markets. At Diyadan Medina, examples of women engaged in entrepreneurial activities are plentiful. Houses in Diyadan Medina, which were in limited supply, seem to have often passed generationally through the female line rather than the male line, and husbands joined their wives' households instead of the reverse. In the home itself, thought to be a female realm, images of fertility and female roles were omnipresent. Six houses at Diyadan Medina still have images of the deity Bes, who played a major role in all issues pertaining to childbirth and sexuality. Fertility was central to ancient Egypt in a whole bunch of different ways, and women's lives were defined by what the Egyptologist Lynn Meskel calls a, quote, continual cycle of conception, pregnancy, and birth that preoccupied women from puberty to menopause. In all of these ways, women did have some agency, freedom, and space to operate. They had a lot more than in some other places in the ancient world. But it's easy to overstate this. In theory, women had abundant legal rights, including that of inheritance, the right to keep a woman's property in the event her marriage was dissolved. But reality was considerably different. Women were much more often defendants than claimants in legal suits, and men divorced women at four times the rate that women divorced men. Women were listed in tax registers as landholders, but the evidence for them actually controlling their property is absent. When images depicted married couples together, women were almost always shown in a subservient role. In the inscriptions on tomb stelae, men were defined by their titles, but their wives were defined by their marital status. Women seem to have married much younger than men. According to one New Kingdom instructional text, women were socially mature and marriageable by 12 or 13, but men only at age 20. In cross-cultural comparison, that kind of age gap at marriage tends to point very strongly toward a major gender divide. Diyadan Medina was full of children. Parents seem to have hoped for sons, but they cared deeply about their children from the moment they were born. Now, there's a common idea that because of the frequency of infant mortality in the ancient world, around 40 to 50% of the bodies in one sample of ancient Egyptian cemeteries belonged to infants, that parents somehow weren't emotionally invested in their young children. This is totally false. The very youngest children had their own section of the eastern necropolis at Diyadan Medina. It's right at the bottom of the hill. The further up the hill one went, the older the occupants, but at every stage, children were given real burials, often with grave goods. Boys followed their fathers to work in the Valley of the Kings to learn their trades, and daughters learned from their mothers. As children grew into adults and adults reached old age, they remained a part of their communities. I mentioned that older male workers at Diyadan Medina often retired and even bribed the foreman to ensure that their sons got their positions. There's abundant evidence for these kinds of arrangements, like the workman Wesket Nemtet, who gave his father over half of his monthly salary. Children were expected to provide for their parents as they became elderly, and we know from the remains found in burials at Diyadan Medina that people could live to an advanced age. One woman named Ineferti was at least 75 at her death. Woe to the children who didn't help their aging parents. The will of a woman named Naunachta makes a point of saying that she leaves nothing to her eight children because, quote, I have become old and look, they do not care for me. I will not give of my property. Naunachta was a common woman. She may not have had much to pass on, but she got the last word in. I think it's fitting to end with Naunachta. She wasn't a wealthy woman, but her will shows her as a person who was determined to make her own choices for her own reasons and to dispose of what she did have as she decided. That's agency. It's the most important thing we can bear in mind as we try to understand the lives of common people in ancient Egypt and the ancient world more generally. We only get these scattered glimpses of their lives. An attendance sheet noting their absence from work on paternity leave. A letter asking for medicine to treat an eye infection. A tomb painting showing a deceased person with her family. A skeleton with fractures of the vertebrae and ribs. But they were people. All of them with their own hopes and dreams and concerns, their aches and pains, their disappointments and their loves. They were stonemasons and farmers, herders and scribes, soldiers and cloth traders, rather than kings and high priests and wealthy administrators. And they deserve to be remembered too. Next time, we'll start to work our way into the final stage of this season of Tides of History. The Bronze Age collapse is coming.
Hey,
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. I've also written a book called The Verge, Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. It's available now on hard copy, ebook, or audiobook from your distributor of choice, and there's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound designed by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers?
That's a butterfly effect.